Okay, we are in a long series of on trying to understand the words of the New Testament. What we, as Steve was pointing out, you know, we do have this historical fact about the person of Jesus of Nazareth about 2,000 years ago. And according to scholars of all persuasion, there are, no matter what you believe about the Bible or not, in terms of your confidence in it, there are five or six things that we are absolutely certain of happened in history, that everybody sort of agrees that works in this field. And one of it is that Jesus of Nazareth was executed by the Roman government outside of Jerusalem about 2,000 years ago. That the death was not faked, that the person was real, and that the execution was despicable, that it was a disgrace, that it was an execution, it was a criminal judgment on the part of the powers that be, and that it was strangely, depending upon, incongruous with the known character of this individual. There was no real reason that we can see why someone that was known for this kind of love and goodness would have somehow ended up on a Roman cross. There's some elements that are missing in the picture. Unless you look into the New Testament and you see some of the confrontation that Jesus had with the religious elite and the political elite of the day, and pretended elitism on the part of even commoners, okay, then you wouldn't understand why the response was so violent, why the response was so intense. And it is that fact of history that we have been trying to look at through the eyes of those around them, in the New Testament specifically, in terms of what the understanding, what happened there at the cross. So if we were there as a Roman soldier looking at the cross, we would see a criminal being executed. If we were a Roman soldier, we would be delighting in the anti-Semitic nature of the act as well. The fact that when Pilate put up their king of the Jews and crucified him, it was an act of ethnic violence as well as just this one individual. When the Jewish elite came and said, no, just say, he said he was the king of the Jews. He said, no. I'm going to make a statement out of this as well. And Pilate, of course, was ambivalent about Jesus. Didn't know what to make of this individual. Strange set of dynamics for Pilate, historically. Those around him, the disciples, on the other side of Easter, on the other side of seeing this risen, victorious, messianic figure that all of a sudden has overcome the worst death in history, something changes. And we get an explosion in history called the New Testament. So we have a series of documents that are inexplicable apart from something as dramatic as a resurrection, a crucifixion, some invasion of God in our space. I'm writing a piece for the Tank, a long one, 200-300 pages. And we'll use that as a syllabus next fall. legend and miracle and fable in the ancient world, and how does the New Testament sort of fit in that genre, and why wouldn't we believe that they were just making it up to package Jesus better to their community and things of this type. And you just don't get stuff as dramatic and as detailed and as life-changing. Miracles were a subject of entertainment. You told around the dinner table, they were like stories. They weren't things that you sacrificed your career for by saying, I'm a Christian. Or you didn't sacrifice your commercial possibilities of having a job in the city of Jerusalem among the elite and saying, I'm a Nazarene. I'm a follower of Jesus. You know, you didn't do that over dinner conversation kind of thing. We'll embarrass ourselves over loyalty to sports teams, you know, the modern culture, but it doesn't go to the point that, yes, Raiders, right or wrong, I'm going to lose my job over these people, you know. But this is the kind of thing we're into here. And so we're trying to understand what happened at the cross. And this was an act that was, foretold in the Old Testament, and it was a surprise. I was reading in the Talmud for my devotions this morning. No, I was reading. I was studying for a piece yesterday. Although you could with profit do that in some places in that place. I was working at, on a piece on John 6, and I was in the Talmud and Book of Succoth, and it was talking about how they have two messiahs. They've got a suffering Messiah and a victorious Messiah. Messiah, son of Joseph, and Messiah, son of David. And Messiah, son of Joseph, the one they attach all the suffering passages, messianic passages to. And the son of David, Messiah, son of David, are the one they attach all the victorious ones. You couldn't put them together in one individual. And so they broke them into two messiahs. And the Messiah and Joseph, they're describing that this is where the Zechariah passed. They will look upon me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. And they were aware of this, that this element was there, that was coming, that there was some kind of messianic disgrace that was to be experienced on the part of Israel's Messiah. And when God would describe in the Old Testament what that future was like, it has an extended description of the Jewish authors of the New Testament. Every book of the New Testament, with the possible exception of Luke, Acts, was written by a baptized Jew in the first century. So this is a sect of Judaism back then, basically a denomination, and they basically have understood the messianic passages in the way that Jesus taught them. This is what it meant. This is what it meant. And here's the authentication, the resurrection. So when we look in the New Testament, they're going to use terms to describe that cross. We looked at one for a long time last year on sacrifice. The one we're on now is that word redemption. And the word redemption, like I say, the reason we're spending so much time on it is that we don't use these words much in Western civilization. So when we come to those holy words in our hymns and things of this type, we sort of gloss over them like words like, I raise my Ebenezer. You know, we don't have a clue, but we sing it with gusto about raising the Ebenezer, right? And sometimes we're that way about redemption. We have a vague notion of what it is. And what we're trying to do in this is get really detailed in terms of when somebody heard that. When Glenn the Pagan gets off the airplane on his trip and somebody says, I found the Redeemer. What would I associate with that? And why would I be interested in talking any further at the information booth there in the airport about this? Okay? And that's where we are. And so we are on page 5, but we're going to back up slightly to the chart that's in on the bottom of page 4, escalation of the problem. The basic notion of redemption has to do with freedom, liberation, release from some kind of oppression or some kind of constraints or restraints that we don't like. It may be things we did ourselves, but there's things that we don't like. And on the category there, I've got the four categories we talked about in the Old Testament version of redemption. And they were oppression, that there are people and things out to get us. Remember the old saying, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean somebody's not out to get you. Remember? There is oppression. There's a consequence engine, where when I do things wrong, there is a consequence engine that was supposed to be for good, but I reap what I sow. The system was built to let me reap what I sow for good so that I could do just a little bit of good and reap all kinds of good. That's the way it was set up to do. A leverage model, we would say, in management. Supposed to be lots of leverage here and multipliers and things of this type. But the same thing applies when I do something destructive. When I mistreat someone, the ripples just keep going through history. Just keep going through history. So the consequence engine gets me in trouble that I become in bondage to. Voluntary slavery, this is where I get in a fix and I have to choose between two evils. This is where I have to choose the lesser of two evils, and they're still just both very, very ugly. And I picked the lesser of two evils, and it's a voluntary thing. I got myself there, and I had to choose it to get myself out of one difficult situation into a different one. And the final one there was alienation. We saw that in the Old Testament, there was this alienation that when I get put in a situation like that of I'm a war captive, or I sell myself into being a house servant for someone, that I'm away from home, that I'm alienated, that I have a sense of restlessness of spirit, that I know I'm not where I belong. I'm on a trip. I'm just on a trip, and I want to get home, and the plane's not flying fast enough. And this sense of alienation, I don't really belong here, I'm just treading water. This is an aspect of what showed up in the redemption model as well. In the Old Testament, as Israel's developing its thought and God's trying to teach them about Himself and about what it's like to live in community and what's it like to be like God to one another in kindness and gentleness and respect, these elements have a particularly human dimension. In other words, treachery is normally another human, and voluntary slavery is something I do, and it's generally confined to just the human historical dimension. And what we saw between our first session here, between the Old Testament and the New Testament, Israel had time to reflect upon this. They backed up, and when they were in Babylon in the exile, and all they had time to do was study Scripture. This is where their Talmuds grew up, and their literature canonization occurred, and things of this type. You know, as they would study to preserve their national identity in a foreign land. And they started reflecting upon this, and God gave them some additional insight. They saw the picture was a little larger. They saw that it wasn't just humans that were the enemy, that there were a larger context, that there was a spiritual dimension that was a little bit larger than just the humans. The humans were a big enough problem as it was. We met the enemy and they as us kind of scenario. But it was also larger than that. There were somehow forces in history, macro-level forces, that somehow worked up at the leadership level. We don't know exactly how it works. There were stories told of Carl Jung, the psychoanalytic leader of Jungian psychology, who as a young man of Jewish background looked at the Holocaust and the anti-Semitic acts in history, through history, and said evil must be larger than just personal. There's got to be something deeper or higher, because this level of evil is just sort of beyond the normal level of evil that we do on one another. There's something transpersonal here. And so he spent his lifetime researching how other forces, archetypal forces, spiritual forces, can interface into a human consciousness. And it was through his archetypes and things of this type that interface was being researched by him. It was just an element that was sort of transpersonal. It was superpersonal. It was larger than life, larger than what would be expected by just leaving us bumping around in an observation room. And so during this time, Israel develops a clearer view that there are other forces above us that are also in this struggle, and that the internal problem is worse than we thought. It's not just a matter of I occasionally do something wrong. It's that when I do something wrong occasionally, it changes my character. It's self-deforming. And so my future, it's easier for me to do that bad habit after I've done it once, and even easier still after I've done it twice. See? Once I start thinking about people that way, it becomes more natural. This is called the second nature, the habitus of Thomas Aquinas. Now, you could literally become somebody else through practice. I remember at a real bleak time of my life, 20 years. For about 6 weeks, I tried those creative visualization things that they tell you, that where you write nice things about yourself on a 3x5, and you read them to yourself in the mirror to try to regain some kind of equilibrium. And for those of us that don't believe themselves, it's hard to do that. But you go through the motions anyway. Right? You go through the motions. And so you'll say something nice about yourself, and then there's that little inside voice that finishes every one of those with, yeah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. You know. And so, but eventually you can outrun this, because language does have power and things of this type. And so the inside has its own set of dynamics that it brings to the table as I interact with myself. The notion that there's a model that philosophically we have about subjectivity and objectivity. And let me we covered this years ago, so for those of you that remember this, you can sleep through this little section. And it has to do with subjectivity flowing to objectivity. And what I mean by that is that I sit here and I live in this cognitive, emotional, volitional world as a conscious being. And I have a range of choices on any given day or any given event. And I have a certain level of freedom as to which I choose. So I can choose this. And if I choose this particular path and then I do something, once I choose it, it flows out into reality, flows out into history, and it becomes concrete. Before I do it, it's just a little thought floating around in the head. But once I act upon it by what I speak, what I do, or things of this type, it flows into history and then it becomes concrete. It now becomes a boundary on me for my next set of actions. So if I decide in a fit of folly to cut off my thumb, okay, and I act upon it, I am now conditioned. My future acts of thumb wrestling with my kids is now foreclosed. I no longer have that as an option. In other words, now my subjective choice created an objective condition that now conditions my future subjective choices. See? In other words, this is the way the model is supposed to work. If I persist in doing good, if I have by reason of use have trained my senses to discern good and evil, as Hebrews, the author of Hebrews says, it gets easier and I get more sensitive and then my options get wider. As part of why this topic is important and why it's important to understand grace, because grace is related to this freedom thing. And it's more when I practice freedom that I become more free. My choices get wider and self-control gets easier and things of this type. So it's one of these spirals, and so you get discouraged easily when you say, well, I'm free, and I you don't experience that because historically you're still here. But when you start small steps of freedom, you get wider and you grow it. God blesses that through this leverage model. So the problems coming into the New Testament have historical and it has super historical and has deep inside problems. I mean, I'm aware that, like Paul, that when I want to do good, evil is right there with me making its counter suggestions as to how I should act, how I should think, how I should feel, how I should respond, how I should not think, act, feel, respond, whatever. Okay? So the dimensions got a little bit larger. They're still real in just the personal. We still have those dimensions. It's not a matter of the devil made me do it model. It's just the problem has gotten a little more serious and a little less encouraging moving into the New Testament period. So now we move to new material on page 5. And there are three sets of words that are translated redeem or buy back or that are related to the word redemption in the New Testament. And I'm going to give a quick overview of these before we dive into the main one. The first one is litron, or litron. And this word originally comes from lio, means to loose or release. So when you would, for example, untie a colt, you would use the word luo. I untied the colt. Okay, that's the luo kind of word, loosening. When you took off a coat, you loosened your garments, your shawl, you would luo them. Which could be applied to clothes as well as prisoners. You could loose a prisoner. You could free a prisoner. You would luo the prisoner. In time, the tron suffix was added to it, indicating means of loosing. Litron thus became means of release or ransom price for prisoners and slaves. So when you would buy a prisoner and free them, the price that was paid became lutron, and all the words surrounding lutron, lutronistic, those kinds of things. Okay? In time, an entire specialized word group formed around about lutron itself, focused on ransom of slaves and ransom of prisoners, and occasionally on release of debt securities. Remember in the Old Testament, you know, you could pawn your field, basically you could sell your field, your house, but you could redeem it. And it eventually became used, lutron, in the New Testament. So sometimes it's used as this, not inside the New Testament, but in Greco-Roman parlance. Its main focus of this word, lutron, is on the idea of freedom or release via payment. So when you come across the word redemption, you ask the question, which word are we talking about here? If it's luo, sort of the main notion there is freedom. It costs somebody something. It costs a payment. But the end result is complete freedom. Somehow you get freedom out of this model. This word and its related terms forms the bulk of the Greek New Testament words translated ransom or redemption. So more times than not, when you run across redemption, hiding behind that English word is lutron, and the notion is freedom. The second word set, and we'll spend most of our time on lutron for that reason that it's the dominant one in the New Testament. The second word is agorazo, and exagorazo. And this is your basic commercial word, to buy. And its focus is on transfer of ownership. I bought it, I own it. It comes from the word agora, right, which is marketplace, basically. And it's a commercial word. And the emphasis there is upon ownership, transfer of ownership. It is used in many places in the New Testament for regular commercial transactions, buying food. Jesus sent them to buy food for the Last Supper, for example. Where shall we buy food for so many people? And in a couple of places dealing with the subject of redemption. The most notable that you would be familiar with is carved in wood in the front of the sanctuary. You are bought with a price, therefore you are not your own. That is agorazo or ex agorazo. Okay, so that's a commercial word. Loose.
The X
is just an... it originally would have been an intensive phrase back before the New Testament. It doesn't mean much now in the New Testament. Older commentators will talk about the out, X meaning out of, and so they'll draw these vivid descriptions of being bought out of the slave market of sin. Agorazo, being bought out of. It's harder to press that. It might mean that, but by the time we get the New Testament, it just looks like a synonym for buy. So we'll talk when we get into the details of slave transactions in the New Testament. We'll talk about what extent the marketplace was there, where were the marketplaces, and how actually slaves were traded in the New Testament world. So, good question. And then the last one is my favorite, parapuilomai. I had to practice saying that last night.
I wonder why.
Absolutely, right. And don't bring me with flowers in case of you. That was some word in Hawaiian. I don't know. It might be, this occurs only once in the New Testament. It's common outside the New Testament and the Septuagint. It occurs in Acts 20:28, and its usage there conforms to its extra-biblical focus on the owner's emotional attachment to his possession, a treasured possession. Acts 20:28 is when he's talking about the Lord purchased the church with his blood. And purchased there is this word. And in the Old Testament where you get the two Hebrew words for a treasured possession, you will be my treasured possession. It's rendered one word in the Septuagint, which is Greek, and it's this one word. So the notion there is like that pearl of great price, where he delights in it. It's a possession, but there's an emotional attachment, delight, that's unusual about this particular possession that's used of his church. That's you and me. That God's delight over us is expressed in that particular word. So those are the three words that we're going to look at. We'll spend most of our time on lutron because it's by far and away the heaviest image in the New Testament. And it is also the most encouraging one at some level because of the notion of freedom that's associated with that. So let's dive into lutron. And we have a massive amount of dry and dusty detail to cover here about the background. But it's important to see what this would mean to these people. The social background of the word lutron is Greco-Roman slavery. And I'm going to still use the word slavery because even though we're going to see how different this is than our common notions of slavery in the Western world, just because we don't have a whole lot of range of words. In the ancient Near East, you had all different kind of words for involuntary servitude and indentured servants. And, we don't have a whole lot in the Western world because our experience has been so shaped by our experiences of the New World slave trade that it's hard to come up with ranges of what servitude meant, especially in the ancient world. So first let's talk about Greco-Roman slavery. How extensive was it? How many slaves were there kind of thing in the New Testament that this word would have meant something special to? Okay, but a sense of the scale of what was involved derives from the estimates that for the generation from about 65 B.C. to about 30 B.C., so roughly around the time that Jesus was born and grew up, 100,000 new slaves were needed each year in Italy, and that from 50 B.C. to A.D. 150, more than 500,000, half a million, new slaves were needed every year for the empire as a whole. So that's half a million people every year needed New Testament slavery. In contrast, in the 3.5 centuries of New World slavery, we're talking U.S., Caribbean, and Brazil, the annual average of people transported to the Americas as slaves has been calculated at 28,000, smaller number, with an annual peak average of 60,000 when the slave trade was at its height. Okay? At the end of the 1st century B.C., the servile population of the Roman heartland lay, according to modern estimates, in the order of 2 to 3 million, representing a third to four-tenths, two-fifths, of the total population. So that means you walk out into the marketplace, basically at least a third, if not half of those people that you're going to run to, are in the category of servitude of some type. Okay, so it's pretty extensive. Where did they get these slaves? Okay. First source, the oldest source, was Roman military conquest. Remember our wartime images in the Old Testament, where Israel was going to be captive and enslaved by Assyria and by Babylon. The Roman military conquest, these were mostly before the time of Christ. Much is heard in the sources of enslaving a vanquished enemy in mass, in total. A habit in the Romans probably acquired as their military and political influence spiraled throughout the Italian peninsula in the 4th and early 3rd centuries B.C. So when the army would go and capture a city, everybody in the city would become a servant, would become a slave. They give examples here, as Rome is growing from, you know, in its power, as it's spreading through through Italy. Rival Etruscan city of Veii, 10,000 slaves, the entire city, the siege of Aspis and Carthage, 20,000, third war against Carthage, 55,000, the tribes north in Europe, 25 BC, 44,000, another city of 100,000. See, these are large-scale, en masse enslavements. It does not follow, however, that all war captives were automatically conveyed from the site of capture, as far away as that might be, for disposal in the marketplaces of the Roman heartland. At times, Roman commanders allowed prisoners to be ransomed so freedom might be recovered fairly quickly if relatives or friends were available to pay the necessary price. Likewise, captives were often sold off on the spot to itinerant dealers or distributed to the troops as a form of payment or bonus. So the Roman army goes and fights a foreign army, and the foreign army is trying to protect the city. Okay? All right, they capture the foreign army, and immediately there's a sale right there. In other words, they capture them. They're either going to take them back to Rome as servants, slaves, okay, or are they going to go back to the city and say, do you want to buy any of your people back? And so they would ransom them back to wealthy people of the city that would buy their relatives, and they would lutron. They would pay a price to recover that which was lost. Okay, there were also slave traders that would follow the armors, buzzards, of which Paul spoke, they don't make the cut. In the New Testament, he talks about, in his list of horrible sins, he has the word slave traders. And that's the group that followed the army. And so that if they didn't buy them, they would buy them on the spot and then sell them at a markup throughout the Mediterranean slave trade. Okay? So they were one source of a major source of input of these slaves was through Roman conquest. Josephus talks about in the Jewish War, and some of the numbers are probably inflated a little bit because of Josephus's tendency to do that. He's mentioned 2,000 women and children enslaved at Jaffa, 30,000 at Tiberias in Galilee, 97,000 at Jerusalem. 700 sent to Rome just for the victory march, when they marched through the city with the victory. Yeah, Ted.
This then would be the Jews, because it
was breaking up the family. Oh, huge. Absolutely. This is like this. I mean, to the Jews, I mean, they're going to have the thing about Babylon. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land?
They're going together.
Right, they're going together there. The breakup. See, legally, and we'll get into this in a few minutes, but legally when you became a servant, you were dead. You were literally dead. And so all your family ties were gone because now you're dead. You're no longer connected. And so, yeah, it was a huge one there because now a lot of times in this particular case, they would have captured all, they would have taken families as well. But in the case of the armies where they were fighting, you would have
those
the major...
Following.
Right, absolutely. They would break them up. Yeah, they would sell those. They would break those up because they could use that as an incentive later to try to earn your freedom, which we'll talk about, to be reunited with your loved one. But generally, you lost all contact. This is that theme of alienation, see, that we saw in the Old Testament. This is the thing where You know, everything that's home is gone. Everything that's home is gone. And so, yeah, absolutely, it's a total issue. Not to mention just working for the Gentiles, which is a separate problem. Cato, who is particularly cruel as a slave master in by Roman terms, especially brought prisoners of war when they were still little, so that they could be raised and trained like young dogs or athletes, so you wouldn't know any better. Often in antiquity, wars were waged just to acquire laborers, and the armies were followed by slave merchants. The axiom occurs constantly. The one who was taken in war belongs to the conqueror. This is Aristotle. Okay, the brightest minds that the pagan world knew up to this point just were convinced that when you were a war captive, boom, you die. You now were property of somebody else. And that was built into nature, according to these people, Aristotle and Plato. One who was taken in war belongs to the conqueror. The law of war transformed prisoners into slaves, Heliodorus and Philo. The prisoner, who was like captured booty, Plato, took on an exchange value and would not be freed except for ransom. So in this world, if you were captive of war, you no longer were human, you were essentially property, and you were also dead. You were legally dead without, generally speaking, any rights before law. Now that's the theory. We'll talk about the practice was a little bit different. Yes? No, they didn't have this kind of slave. They had house servants that were allowed, like under the Old Testament, a little bit. And they did pick up categories of, you know, of their general culture around. So they had slavery. They had house servants, but they had very strict rules as to how you had to treat them. You know, their ethical system wouldn't let them do some of the stuff that the Romans did, for example. So, you know, they did hedge a little bit on that because the Old Testament was very strong against it, very strong against slavery. Remember, it was the only nation that forbade extradition. If a runaway slave from a foreign country ran to Israel, Israel could not turn them back over to their master in the foreign country. They were required under the Mosaic law to let them have free reign of the country. They were free people. It was asylum. In the fullest sense of the word, they could live anywhere they wanted in Israel. Now, did Israel ever obey the law in the Old Testament? I can't find a whole lot of passages that seem to indicate that they did. I really can't. And they enslaved people, you know, late in the Old Testament. It was part of the problem in the minor prophets, how they enslaved their own kinfolk into this kind of slavery. So, yeah, they had it. It was not authorized by God, but they were at least better about it than generally the culture around them. So, yeah, they did. But now they didn't do war captives. Now that's a they didn't acquire them. They did all theirs through negotiating in the marketplace. That's how they would get them, and then through this next category, being born in the household. The war is acquired labor, and I just brought two passages. If you'll look at this, you'll see the an allusion to this that Paul makes there in a second. For by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved. See, that's that image. That when I am conquered by something in a combat, by some habit, some oppressive habit or bad thought patterns or actions or passivity in some cases, I'm enslaved by that. And that's alluding to this kind of model. And then Paul said, I see another law at work in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of that law of sin at work within my members. See, this is being conquered and therefore then being enslaved. Being conquered and then enslaved.
What would you say the Israelites enjoyed or despised as slaves, so to speak, in Egypt before the Exodus?
From their standpoint? You mean from the Israelites?
Like slavery.
Yeah, okay. What's strange about that is that, you know, they want to end up going back. They like the stability of the environment. You know, they like the leeks and the garlic and onions. Remember, because they complain about this in the wilderness. But it was mostly that it was a harsh taskmaster. You know, that they were constantly being abused by the authorities for oppressive reasons. And it was, this was not, as we'll see when we get into New Testament servitude. I could be a rich person in a country away from Rome, and I would sell myself into Roman slavery because I could generally be guaranteed by the time I was 30 It's a little late now, but by the time I was 30, I would be free to be a citizen of Rome and have money to boot. It's almost like going into the military to come out with a pension and an educational right. Whereas, so it wasn't necessarily a oppressive to keep me down kind of thing like New World was and like Egypt was. So in Egypt, remember, it was to keep, historically, the Pharaoh in Egypt had problems with external forces. And he had this disenfranchised group of Israelites that nobody liked. They were called the Vile Asiatics, along with all the Syrians and everybody that was non-Egypt in the day, sort of, you know. And there was a concern at the time that they would ally with this external force. And because they were so big and powerful, it's a matter of the only way, how are you going to control this group? And his option was violence. And so it was an oppressive kind of slavery, and therefore different than this kind altogether. Good question.
But that's always going to happen when the numbers get big enough and there's so many slaves.
Well, it depends upon the economic model. We'll see that there are slave households that have 10,000 slaves in the Roman thing. But because the economic model changed, they're incentivized. They started doing the carrot instead of the stick model. So you could earn your way out. You started doing. They started doing profit sharing. Right. They changed. The model changed. Right. Because historically you had Spartacus. You had the slave revolts in the first, you know, 200 BC plus or minus about 100 years. You got the great Roman slave revolts. The slave revolts are not by the people that live in the cities. Because the slaves that live in the cities have sort of got it good. These are the plantation slaves in the Roman plantation. The economy changed to where that doesn't make sense. And so those start going to land tenants and things of this type. But yeah, the economic model changed. And we'll talk about the arrogance of the Romans. The Romans were they were less into wealth as they were into pomp and circumstance and arrogance. And so what they would do is they would dress their servants the most lavishly as possible and then parade them around the city. Right, so people could say, wow, they must really have a lot of wealth and power if their servants dress better than I do. See, that was a fashion statement. It was this kind of thing. And so if you were on the other end of that as a servant, boy, you came out okay here. You came out pretty good. And you would, and some of the, it's interesting, some of the dialogues is where they would sell that to the owner. Yeah, you got a company car, a company chariot. Yeah, absolutely, with the horses and stuff of this type. So and that's what we're going to have to see is the differences, because it's not going to be all roses, and we'll talk about the abuses that occur in here. But second source was natural reproduction, vernae. Now vernae were born into slavery, and were often preferred for important tasks. They were more expensive, infancy and childhood cost, but they were not troublemakers often. In other words, if I had servants in my house and they had a kid, right, that would be called a verna, and I would get no useful work out of the verna, right, until they were at some working age. So I bore all the cost of education, training, medical care as an owner, as the householder, basically. But in the same time, because of that investment, the nurturing element were there. These people ended up being friends of the owners, and in some cases displacing natural-born children as heirs. So we have situations where Roman householders have kids that are just extremely unruly, that they disown, kick out of the family, and adopt one of the vernae and let all the inheritance flow to them. See, this is not New World slavery we're talking about here. This is not Egyptian slavery, you know, Old Testament Egyptian slavery here. There's something different. So vernae were born. They were more trustworthy. But having children could bring slaves certain benefits in real terms. Columella, who was a particularly shrewd, crafty, and to the point of being unscrupulous slave owner in early Rome, I believe that female slaves should be rewarded for bearing children, and said that he himself had given a mother of three time off from work. How much time off with three kids do you get? That's a separate issue, in my opinion. And a mother of more than three children, her freedom as well. So they would incentivize them to go this cheaper route, although, practically speaking, it wasn't cheaper because you had all the child care costs, as opposed to buying a servant in the marketplace. but you had a loyalty and a nurture and a closer relationship here with those born in here because of that growing up there than you would the risk of buying an outsider and bringing them in. Yes?
Why does it smell like engineering people?
Well, it is engineering. Some of these people were acquired specifically for engineering projects, but that's a separate issue. I don't give them this much cleverness, actually. We're overstating how clever they are. They are shrewd and practical, but it's a matter of they have to ebb and flow with the real realities of life. So they do think through. I mean, there are whole manuals on how to deal with servants, how to manage them, just like we get management manuals today on employees, our kids. You know, so it's an issue of how you deal with something that's legally classified as an asset, but that's actually a person. It has personal characteristics, and so you can't just treat it like a stone or a cart, because there's a lot of interaction and interplay that goes on because of the personal dimension. And we'll get into, like I say, we've got to get into that as we go a little further too. But source one was military conquest, two was natural reproduction, third was rescue from exposure, intended infanticide. Another professor of literature included in Suetonius' collection, who was once a slave. So this was a university professor who started out as a slave, but apparently got his education, generally at the householder's expense, and became a professor of lit, was C. Milesius, a teacher and author who flourished in the Augustan era, around the time of Christ, and who once actually received a commission from Augustus himself. But Milesius was not a Verna. He was not born in the household. He was born of free parents, but was exposed as an infant and then brought up in slavery by the man who reclaimed him after his parents had abandoned him. In other words, if you were born into a household and they didn't think they could support you or they didn't like the way they lived, they would go put you in the trash heap to die. So that was intended infanticide. At all levels of society, whether due to poverty or fears of overburdening a patrimony in terms of splitting your inheritance up too thin, with too many heirs, infant exposures was a widespread fact of life in the Roman world. But because those who chose to rescue abandoned children were free to raise them as slaves if they wished, infant exposure was also another important means of replenishing the slave supply. The Christian polemicist Tertullian condemn pagans for abandoning their children to certain death from cold, starvation, or being eaten by dogs. So they'd put their kids out on the trash heap. There are modern analogs to that, if you think about it, to die because they couldn't afford to raise them or were afraid of splitting up, not having the quality of life that they were accustomed to, or for whatever reason they were put out there to die. But that would be a source for people that would come and snatch them out and raise them as servants in their own household, like this professor of literature. Same level of cost associated with it as a Verna, okay? But it was another source of slaves for the Roman slave supply. International trade is the fourth category. It's smaller. It appeared, therefore, that Roman merchants were constantly traversing the spider web of trading routes that crossed the Mediterranean in search of not salves, but slaves. From locally powerful distant rulers who were willing to exchange captives or even the weaker members of their own communities for the material goods the merchants carry. Now think about this. I'm a citizen of Los Gatos. I've moved since our session last fall. I'm a citizen. If I'm a weaker member, because I don't get out much, the mayor of Los Gatos gets a visit from the International Slave Traders Association from San Francisco, okay, and he says, well, you're carrying some, I'd love some of that stuff, that French bread stuff you make up there, and I'm willing to trade Glen for some. I realize that doesn't buy a lot of French bread, but at least, you know, it's a down payment and installment plan or something. And so they would literally, you know, sell their own captives that they had captured in a foreign war or weaker members of their own community in exchange for goods, and that would go travel. I would travel back to Rome or in San Francisco in this particular case. Another source, and this was piracy, and this was not a good one either, but this was particularly bad and condemned by the Roman Empire, actually. Piracy within the sphere of Roman influence, finally, must be acknowledged as a major means of generating new slaves. At the beginning of Rome's central period, the pilots of Cilicia were already notorious for the scale on which they conducted kidnapping and trafficking activities. The Isle of Delos, where they dumped their victims because they knew Roman merchants were waiting there to receive them, that's the drop-off point, is said to have turned over tens of thousands of slaves daily. Okay, in the early 2nd century B.C. Now, this is before New Testament, but it's how the population is shaping up. What the pirates' activities involved, however, is graphically illustrated by a piece of evidence from late antiquity, one of the newly discovered letters of Augustine, St. Augustine, Christian theologian, which shows, among other things, that at the turn of the 5th century A.D., piracy was still a scourge in the Mediterranean Sea. Augustine spoke in his letter of the formidable presence among the coast of North Africa, and particularly at Hippo Regius, of itinerant slave dealers, Galatians in particular, which is an interesting background to the theme of freedom in the book of Galatians. Why it strikes such a responsive chord to the Galatians, because they were surrounded by this and had a history of this as a city. Who were buying up as slaves, freeborn people captured by independent marauders who made it their business to undertake forays from the coast into remote rural villages in order to hunt down and kidnap as many victims as possible. In one village, the rumor went, they had carried off all the women and children of the community after murdering all the men. So they would go out to small rural communities, kill the men, take the women and children, bring them back, sell them to these pirates. Some local people, Augustine continued, were conniving with the invaders. There was a woman who had a clandestine business specializing in young girls from the interior. There was a man, a Christian at that, who had sold his wife into slavery because he preferred to have the cash. And there were indigent parents selling their children because they needed the cash. Augustine said that it was the practice of the Christian community to use its funds to redeem as many of the kidnapped victims as possible. And in one recent episode, 120 slaves whom the Galatians were boarding or were preparing to board onto their ships had been saved. But the trade itself was so lucrative that there were advocates on hand who wanted to try to recover the reclaimed victims for the slave dealers, so their safety was in real jeopardy. It was a desperate situation, and one that had been far from uncommon throughout the whole of the central period. So what you've got is the church using its collection money, its funds, to go out to the slave market and buy people to set them free. Okay. Would that the New World had remembered that practice centuries later, millennium later, but that they would take their money and do this, and then according to this, as soon as those people were leaving, they're free and they're leaving, there's another group that comes and tries to capture them again and recover them for the slave trader and double the profits. See, this is how bad it was in terms of piracy and slave trading under this scenario. Yes?
You know, the same thing I think is happening in Sudan.
Now, yeah, it is. Absolutely. Absolutely.
The church is buying that family
could have been sold. Right. And that's a controversial one, too, because the government doesn't want them to do that because they think that they're supporting economically. See, once you buy this, once I give them the money to redeem the person, I made the economic thing work. So I support the practice. Does that encourage them to keep doing it? And that's a catch-22 you get into, and it's hard for the group to do. But that's exactly what's going on with Sudan right now. Yeah.
I read that recently there's some archaeological digs going on in Israel looking for the quarters and the camp followers' living circumstances, because they must have been a huge population of people, and they would have been mostly outcast from both societies in some way, or separated. So they've begun looking for them, much in the same way as they did in Egypt.
El Dibir.
Yeah.
Yeah, now, when you get into urban servants lived with the masters. See, they didn't have servants' quarters.
No, this is the camp-following dealers.
Oh, the camp-following dealers, yeah.
All the subterranean distance like these Galatians and so forth.
Right. As it turns out, most of the... Oh, it's 11 o'clock. Most of the trade was done not in specialized slave sites, by the way, but in small, just commercial transaction markets. And most of them in Roman culture was done over the dinner table. I would just make the deal. You know, I'd say, okay, I got an excess, or I need somebody. Can you recommend somebody? And so it was a networking kind of thing. And this last point, let me just read this, and then we'll close with that. Some people actually sold themselves into slavery for differing reasons. Some ambitious men did the same, sold themselves, in the hope of becoming the stewards of noblemen or imperial treasures. This, in my view, was the story of the all-powerful and extremely wealthy Pallas, scion of a noble Arcadian family, who sold himself into slavery so that he might be taken on as steward, butler, by a woman of the imperial family, and he wound up as the minister of finance in the Roman Empire, in eminence Greece to the Emperor Claudius. We know many among ourselves, this is a Clement of Rome, Christian, we know many among ourselves who have given themselves up to slavery in order that they could ransom others. Many others have surrendered themselves to slavery so that with the price that they receive for themselves, they could provide food for others. So the Christians, the motives would be different for selling yourself into slavery to rise to power versus selling yourselves to slavery to free somebody else, taking their place. This is a New Testament theme, if you don't recognize this, who, though he was rich for your sake, became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. That trading places kind of model. And so the motives were slightly different, but some people actually did this. There was a large supply of these late in the empire. And we'll talk about the dynamics of that when we get together again next week, an hour earlier than we did this morning. Let's close in a word.